Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this Tuesday Tech Check Plus live stream. It's been a while since I've done one of these, but I'm thrilled to have with me Zach Bray, co-founder and CEO of Plaid, and Aaron K. Rooney. Thanks for being here. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being on TV about 15 minutes ago, half an hour, I suppose. We got to some of the top level stuff, but I want to go back a little bit and talk about you came out, company came out with these 2023 FinTech predictions. What was sort of the number one prediction? What were people most interested in when you had that session?
So this is a thing that we tend to do every year. We come up with our FinTech predictions. I think this started from me writing a tweet from a plane maybe 7 years ago when we were a very small company.
What did you tweet then?
It was just a screenshot of a bunch of these different
ideas. Did they come true?
I think we were about 50-50 that year. Okay. I think in general, we're probably 60-40. Some of them are
threads, by the way. I feel like you were a really thread person on Twitter.
It was, yes. It's a screenshot essay in some sense. So this year, we predict that FinTech's going to have a banner year in many senses, but it's going to be very different than what you might have said last year or the year before. We've seen a shift in the way that the market is growing, and you've obviously seen a pullback in venture funding into a lot of, especially the later stage digital finance companies. Early stage is very healthy, but later stage, you've seen less investment there. You've seen a pullback of some of the marketing budgets. That said, the fundamentals are still very, very strong about the market. You're seeing consumers still really value using digital financial products. I said this earlier, but 70% of consumers use a digital financial product on a week-to-week or a month-to-month basis. And consumers don't want to go backwards. They don't want to go back to paper. But what we are also seeing is a huge shift towards many of the large technology companies, the large banks, building digital financial products. And so you'll see a kind of a shift where much of the innovation is actually coming from the larger enterprises as opposed to the smaller startups. So we're excited. We think that we build fundamental kind of foundational infrastructure for fintech, and we're excited that that's going to continue to push forward.
That's interesting that you say that as a fintech, that you think it's going to be the traditional players or the larger fintech players.
So I think that a lot of this year, you're going to see a bunch of announcements coming from the big banks and medium banks and some of those ones as well, and the large technology companies. I think that's going to move a little faster, frankly, than the other parts of the market.
I wondered too, with that 80% stat about consumers using sort of digital finance, do you guys have a sense of how much of that is a bank, or a tech company, Apple Pay, Google Pay, versus, you know, a Venmo of the world? And has that shifted at all in the past couple of years? What have you seen in terms of trends there?
Yeah, so we run this survey each year. I call the FinTech Trend Survey, and we do this in partnership with the Harris Poll. And this is our attempt to really understand what consumers are saying, what they're thinking, what they're wanting. Some of the consistent things that come out of it are consumers deeply value simplicity and they value safety. They value being able to do things easily in their financial lives, and they, of course, value that their money is secure, that the products that they're using are secure and take care of them from a privacy perspective. These are things that we deeply value at Plaid as well. And so when we start to look at what the consumers are actually using, it's a mixture. Some of them are using neobanks, some of them are using digital banking experiences, but many of them are trying things like budgeting tools for the first time. This year, actually, and over the past few months especially, we've seen a large resurgence of growth in any tools that help consumers manage their budgets, spend less, understand how they're spending, and have a better picture into their financial life. And so that's a trend we expect to continue this year.
Is that an inflation impact? Are you seeing any different consumer behavior in terms of savings or maybe less investing? I wonder what impact inflation has had and what do you expect to go forward?
Well, I think the bigger trend is actually economic uncertainty and pressure coming on consumer incomes, or some questions coming about consumer income. So as consumers are more nervous about what their income is going to look like in 6 or 12 months, they're being prudent with their spend now. So you see applications like Truebill, which is now called Rocket Money. They're building tools to help consumers manage the bills that are coming in, manage their money. And you've seen them just continue to grow in a really exciting way. I expect that applications like that are going to continue.
I'm so fascinated by this sort of broader prediction that you think it's the bigger institutions and big tech that are going to drive innovation going forward. I mean, isn't fintech supposed to be displacing these companies and doing it better? Isn't it kind of a backlash that JP Morgan Chase savings account offers you 0.001 APY still today? So is that good for the consumer that it's the big companies, the legacy companies that you think are going to be the ones innovating? Because those are the ones that have typically underserved the underbanked and led to this explosion of fintech.
Well, maybe I should clarify my statement okay. there. I think the banks, many of the big banks and the large technology companies are going to be the ones driving a lot of the innovation over the next year. Okay. That's not forever.
Okay.
And the reason I say this is you look at those that have the biggest budgets and that can benefit the most from making a shift to digital. Every company is talking about how to cut costs, how to manage their business prudently. And when you look at many of the larger companies, they're the ones that actually have the most opportunity from going digital. So putting in place digital technologies that will bring down their spend, bring down their cost to serve their consumers this year. And then as things start to tick up, as things start to grow next year, they'll be able to benefit from
that. That's the key, right? That's the scale, and they have the money in this tougher macro environment where investors are putting greater emphasis on profitability. But again, is that good for the consumer, right, Kate? Like, we spent a lot of time talking about this, how banks started the overdraft fees that burned a lot of young consumers when they were starting. So does scale and sort of cash right now equal more innovation, at least in the short term? I understand what you're saying.
So I think more opportunities, more products for consumers are a great thing. As consumers have more choice, they're going to be able to live better financial lives. You know, I grew up in a very small town. There was a bank in our town. And my parents were able to get some accounts from that bank, but they weren't able to get all their accounts from that bank, so they had to travel a long way. Having access to digital financial products would have been great for my parents. They would have had kind of better tools and services that were available to them. And I think that that's consistent. But one thing I will say is it's not as if early stage startup innovation is not happening. It is. We've grown our customer base by double digit percentage points here over the past year. And as we look at the early stage, we are seeing a lot of innovation, a lot of new ideas coming out there. But when you think about the usage from consumers, it's not as much coming from a kind of expansion of growth stage companies right now. It's coming from some of the larger companies that are having the budgets and are having the existing user bases that they can distribute their new products into.
I wonder, speaking of banks, a lot of the smaller community banks have been sort of providing banking as a service, or BaaS, as some are starting to call it, instead of SaaS. Is that going to continue? Do you think some of these small regional banks will keep partnering with fintechs, or will it become some of the bigger Wall Street banks, or will the fintechs decide, like SoFi did, to either go out and buy their own community bank and get a bank charter? Are you starting to see more fintechs wanting to become actually a regulated bank?
I think the answer to that is yes, yes, and yes. So yes, I suspect that we'll continue to see community banks, small and medium-sized banks, that are partnering with fintech to help them build the infrastructure. I suspect that we'll see some of the larger banks jump in and actually start to partner with fintech, because that is a great revenue opportunity, a growth opportunity. And yet I expect some of the fintechs, as best they can, to apply for these bank charters. We have seen a shift in the regulatory environment, though. We're seeing the regulators put much more scrutiny on the partnership programs between fintechs and banks. And, you know, in short term, that certainly causes questions, causes slowdowns in some areas. But in the long term, I think that's a really good thing. I think it's great that we're getting more regulatory clarity on how banks can partner with fintechs. And we're actually seeing a couple interesting areas really emerge. So the banks are putting, or the regulators are putting a big focus on know your customer products, know your customer kind of rules, yeah. Ensuring that the banks and the fintechs themselves are deeply going in and verifying the identities. That's a trend I suspect to continue. So more regulatory scrutiny, I expect.
What about for you guys? So as the middleman and having this sort of API, you know, data detection, consumer protection is a big focus, especially for bank regulators. I wonder what that looks like as different fintechs get into this, and sort of your take on if it's what the right amount of oversight is on know your customer laws, on consumer protection, while still allowing innovation.
Yeah, that's a good question. So for us at Plaid, we deeply believe that consumers need to have access to their data, but they need to have it in a secure manner, and they need to have the proper privacy protections in place. And that's been foundational to how we've built our company and how we've tried to encourage the ecosystem. I think greater regulatory involvement, greater regulatory questions, that's generally a good thing, generally positive for consumers, is protectionary for consumers. However, we have to ensure that there's technology to meet the growing regulatory demand. So for us, actually, last year, we made a big investment in identity verification. We built an identity verification product, and that's grown really, really well within our customer base. The second area is risk and fraud protection tools. So we've made a huge investment there and have a couple of new products that came to market last year that have done very well. And we actually suspect that over the coming year, those are going to be two of our fastest growing product lines. We hope that the technology is there to meet the regulatory need.
Zach, do you know Alex Rampal, Andreessen Horowitz?
I do know him.
Were they investors in Plaid?
Alex is an investor in Plaid, yeah.
Okay, got it. He had this fascinating tweet thread the other day talking about Target's debit card and how it's essentially allowed the company, a retailer, to save so much money by connecting consumers directly, they're connecting their ACH to this card and they bypass the rails essentially. Is that something that Plaid helps with?
So I can't comment on the specifics of our customers in some of these senses, but what I will
say
is...
The idea of it then.
Yeah,
he was making the point that it saved them billions of dollars, right, in merchant fees.
Yeah, so the concept of using bank-linked payments is something that a lot of retailers at over many, many years. But if I'm honest, we're still very early in the use of bank-linked payments for retail. We see bank-linked transfers existing in many other parts of commerce, but in retail, it's not happening as much. The Target Red Card is a fascinating case study. And for anyone that hasn't researched it, I strongly recommend you go do a bit of reading on it.
Or read that tweet thread from Alex Rampal. He does a good summary.
Or read the tweet thread, certainly. But what I will say is I suspect that bank-linked payments will become a more used mechanism as, yes, ACH continues to work well, but as FedNow and as RTP start to roll out, that's going to be a safer, easier way for consumers to utilize bank payments. And I suspect that will have a lot of traction.
Where does that leave the rails, Visa and MasterCard?
You know, I've said this before, but I can't comment on Visa and MasterCard specifically. And
the rails. We won't say who.
The more rails that are out there, the better for the consumer.
Really?
The more options that they have, the better for the consumer. Now, consumers
won't
use...
But what about the merchant?
I think that's also good for the merchant. So
they have to pay to use the rails.
I think the security thing is the other... Their argument has been that they provide data protection, security. They're doing such a massive lift on the back end that they are actually really putting a service. And then the regulatory argument has been that it's a duopoly and there's plenty of reasons on both sides, but it's been interesting. I'm fascinated on what this means for Visa and MasterCard. If you can just bypass that, connect directly to your bank account, and if that erodes fees.
You're now the one that's making it secure, hopefully, you know, to not use them. So it just feels like there's this conflict playing out, maybe?
So what I'll say is, broadly, we think that more ways to move money, more ways to fund accounts, more ways to move your own money around is a good thing for consumers. Whether that's on kind of a traditional credit or debit card rail, whether that's a direct bank link payment, whether that's using a wallet, or whether that's using maybe FedNow or RTP, these new mechanisms that are continuing to roll out, we think that's a great thing. Consumers should have optionality in how they want to move money around. Some consumers are willing to pay more in order to move money faster. Some merchants are willing to pay more in order to move money faster. Some consumers or merchants are willing to wait a little longer and for a little cheaper. And I think the options are great.
Well, there's options, but I have to say, as a Canadian, trying to move my money from Canada to the US, it has gotten no better over the last, 6 years that I've been living here in the US.
Bitcoin is
exactly. That was the promise of crypto. And there's more options, but it feels like I don't need more options. I need a better way. And certainly the underbanks need a better, cheaper way, faster way to do so.
I couldn't agree with you more. But I think the first step to get there is having rails that are rails in many varieties of ways to move money, but having ways to move money that are cheaper, easier, more secure, and more consumer-centric. That's where we play. That's where Plaid thinks about it. Can we build the foundational tools? Then on top of that, we'll have applications that will start to emerge that will start to utilize that and solve these problems. So for example, Wise is a customer of Plaid, and they're very focused on making international transfers.
Still costs money.
It does cost money. It's
and
not
still
perfect.
Takes time, two or three days.
Of course, there's always opportunity to do better, but we think that by continuing to improve the infrastructure, then we will see the application layer sit on top of it and hopefully drive more value to you.
I wonder, you're talking about real-time payments, there's open banking in Europe. The expectation when there was talk of bringing that over to the US was that this would really disrupt Plaid and get rid of the need to have that middleman. If you've got, as a consumer, access to your data, it's a lot easier to take your banking data, connect it to whatever other app. You guys have said the opposite and said, no, we still play a role here. I wonder if you could explain Plaid's relevance going forward if federal real-time payments, open banking come to the U.S., because you guys have really made that argument that, no, we still play a role. But can you sort of explain how that works? Because a lot of people have said, no, this would get rid of the need to even have a Plaid.
Absolutely. So in the U.S., there are something like 10,000, 11,000, 12,000 financial institutions. Then you add on top of that all of the different permutations of those financial institutions and all of the digital financial products, and you have, you know, well more than 10,000 different types of entities. And every user of every one of those types of applications, they want to use every other one of those applications. They want to use fintech. And so the role that we play is integrating with all those applications, making it such that a consumer, if they want to sign up for a new financial product, they can use whatever financial product they have to do so. Now, that's a lot of complexity, and I don't think that complexity is going away. When we look at what open banking has done in Europe, or what kind of Dodd-Frank and the implementation of the kind of open banking provisions or open finance provisions of Dodd-Frank will bring to the U.S., it's clarity and consistency. So the way to integrate with the bank, the way that a bank serves data, the way that a bank gives consumers access to their funds and their data is completely inconsistent in the U.S. Some banks will do it in one way, some banks will do it in the other way. We build infrastructure to help banks do it in a third way and a fourth way. And the complexity there is very high. Over time, we hope that the open banking rules will make the complexity more straightforward, and they'll give the consumers additional confidence that if they want to use a certain type of product, that it's going to work really, really well for them.
And that's been the promise, right? Reducing that friction. Zach, well, we just have a few minutes left. I just want to touch on, you know, it was only a few years ago that Visa made that acquisition. It was shot down by the regulators. How do you feel almost 2 years on from that? And what's your appetite for deals right now, whether Plaid is the target or doing some yourself in this moment where it feels like a lot of consolidation is needed?
So I feel incredibly fortunate in the situation that we ended up in. Obviously, history of Plaid, we had a Visa deal. We then did a big fundraising round after that. And the reason we chose to go in that direction at the end of the day was that we felt that there was so much opportunity out there, and the market, even through COVID, had fundamentally shifted for digital finance. And that's something I still very deeply believe. So when I look ahead to the next 2, 3, 4 years, predict the next 12 months is going to be a different one than most technology companies have been used to, and it's going to be an exciting one in a lot of senses as well. But then, as we start to think about recovery in 2024, 2025, fintech just as a market is poised to have a great set of growth years. So that's really what we're laser focused.
So you're
on.
Looking for an IPO eventually.
At some point. That's not the immediate focus right now.
Versus, did it sort of solidify your desire to be a standalone company, or do you still think about what it would be like to be one of these big institutions that you say they have the money and the scope to really innovate over the next year at least?
Well, I think at this point we're most likely on the path towards an IPO, and that's an end state that we are, or I guess I should say an interim state or a milestone that we're very excited for at some point. But it's not the immediate focus right now. Right now we're just laser focused on supporting our customers through this period of uncertainty and helping them continue to grow.
What about the acquirers? So thinking of Visa, MasterCard, even big tech with what's gone on in antitrust, do you have the sense that there are companies out there that, even if they have enough cash on their balance sheet, could do these deals to buy a Plaid or buy a Chime or one of these late stage growth companies? Based on your experience, you know, with the DOJ and everything that happened with Visa, do you expect that that's even a possibility at this point?
I've learned that me pontificating on M&A and certainly me pontificating on antitrust regulation, I don't have the best guesses on that. But what I will say is, I think there are a lot of opportunities to bring together best-in-breed technology with best-in-breed financial services. And over the past few years, we've seen a number of instances where large financial institutions have bought smaller fintech companies. Some have gone incredibly well. Not all of them have gone incredibly well, but some of them have gone very well. I suspect that if companies do struggle, that's a trend that we will see continuing.
Right. I think we have to leave it there because we're out of time. But thank you so much for joining us on the show and now in the live stream. And thank you to those that were watching. as always, Kate Rooney, partner here at SF.
Yeah.
So we'll end this and hope you come back soon.
Thank you so much.
And we'll do like a checklist maybe at the end of the year.
I don't know what you got wrong. So we'll check back in 2024.
Yeah, exactly.
What worked and what didn't.
And I'd like to see that list, the original list. It'd be interesting to see what 6 or 7 years on.
Yeah. Well, I'll find it and send it to you. Thank you for having me.
That'd be great. Thank you so much.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.